Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Leighton, a little bit under the weather today, but he's fighting through to get you the latest retail news and stories from the world of retail, as well as food. We'll talk a little Chipotle and Taco Bell later on in the show. We'll also discuss GNC and a partnership with a company from China. And we close out today's show by talking about Genesco and their endeavors to divest lids from their portfolio. Our interview guest today is Gary Lee. He is the Chief Solutions Officer with Stratix. He'll talk about the deployment of mobile as an employee retail solutions tool. But first, we remind everyone to rate us on iTunes or wherever you find us as we launch into this story with Home Depot and Lowe's announcing their seasonal hiring plans. This is always a fairly big story for especially those news outlets that kind of copy and paste press releases out there. But I think the big story here, Lowe's has a bigger proposed increase over last year with their seasonal hiring plans. And this could mean positive things potentially for that company. Both companies have performed exceedingly well in their retail sectors as people are choosing to make home improvements with what discretionary income they have available. And we'll start with the larger of the two here, Home Depot. Home Depot, bigger, a $218 billion versus an $80 billion market cap for Lowe's. So they need more seasonal help and Leighton, these plans about the same as last year.
Absolutely. And you mentioned that they are bigger in terms of market cap. One of the reasons there is because they have more locations, obviously. The location sizes are pretty equivalent, but with Home Depot, you've seen really big quarters in the past couple of years. A lot of people, a lot more people coming into their stores and making these purchases. And you think of the spring and summer months, a lot more people get out and about, and the weather is going to be fairly nice this year, or at least we'll talk about that here in a little bit. It looks as though a lot more people are going to be making some more lawn and garden purchases, but also some other purchases. But in order to support those people, they need to have more seasonal workers. So Home Depot has formally announced plans to hire 80,000 more seasonal workers for the spring and summer months. 80,000 seems like a big number, but roughly the same amount of people were actually coming into the company working in seasonal or temporary jobs this time last year. Like we saw over the holidays, retailers are getting more proactive and creative in their overall hiring process to better streamline the ability to apply and also schedule interviews with applicants. Home Depot has admitted via press release that they have actually been using a candidate self-service app to identify potential recruits. Since November, in fact, this innovative tool has been available for the company. Those who get through the initial process here can schedule their own interview. This is very interesting, something we don't see a lot from big companies, especially large corporations with an over $200 billion market cap. The company says that 80% of its newest associates so far since November have actually come through this very platform, which to us is just incredible. We have to keep in mind that they will probably be able to access critical data in the future, so they're going to be using this app to their advantage with regards to data and to what aspects the process indicates for the best future worker. So they're going to be able to see what all the worker inputs as they go through the application process and see how that pans out for both the company and the employee. Also, there may be a learning curve with this tool, and they'll have to determine what desirable or undesirable characteristics employees have that are hired through the system and how those are similar or different from traditional computerized personality tests that you see if you were to apply in store, let's say. The company had a robust third quarter, as we talked about on this very podcast, with 8.1% comp, so they are certainly able to take on a bigger workforce. And again, they probably need one, at least in the short term. They are still opening new locations, but are focused more on their supply chain and e-commerce sales to better reach current and future customers at a competitive price point. Again, this plays hand in hand because you have a better inventory management system if you're focusing on supply chain, let's say, but you are able in turn to have a lower price, which actually gets more revenue because more customers are acknowledging that better competitive price in regards to your competitors. They are prepared to spend a pretty penny on extending their reach. As we noted, their reported ongoing interest in XPO Logistics this last month Talks are reportedly still going on with that, but like with Walmart, they have been very bullish on internal expenditures, especially training and technology, Trent, to better assist their employees with in-store opportunities. And this includes safety training above and beyond the typical retailer, something that all home improvement retail firms usually employ.
But outside of their safety training, one of the things that's interesting about Home Depot is they have an internal program called My Orange Ladder. Now, a lot of companies, especially retail companies, will have platforms through which employees can see other areas in which they might be interested in working inside the company. But this goes above and beyond what most retailers do, and it almost elevates them above a Walmart-esque level, because this program, this My Orange Ladder program, actually allows employees to plan their career tracks through an app-based system or through their online system, and then develop their skills and knowledge base as well to reach their personal goals. And this includes training and different forms of on-the-job training, as well as computerized training, so they can kind of map out where their skill sets are. It's one of the most robust training programs we've seen in the retail industry. And the system also allows for plans to jump from their U.S. retail jobs, so their floor-level jobs or maybe their back-of-store jobs, to other support roles like what they call their MET or merchandising execution team, or even working in a role at one of their distributorships. Now, because of Home Depot's optimistic market outlook, the company is hoping to keep a lot of those 80,000 seasonal workers on hand and potentially transfer them into part-time or full-time permanent jobs. Home Depot is hoping that exposing some of these workers to those internal training platforms like My Orange Ladder, for example, and the other forms of employee training that take place at Home Depot while an employee is hired there will invigorate them a little bit further for continued work at the company. The deeper they get, it's thought, within Home Depot, and the deeper they become trained in Home Depot's processes and best practices, the more they'll want to remain at the company because they feel like they have a role there. But one of the other things that the seasonal tag also does, at least from an HR perspective, it allows for an easier weed out of your employees who aren't working out for whatever reason. So you don't necessarily need a glaring reason, employee theft, for example, to let an employee go. If an employee just isn't working out with your internal culture, with them having that seasonal tag, it's a little bit easier to just say, hey, the season's over, we're going to have to cut you free. Now, the willingness to keep seasonal employees that Home Depot has this year, that's something Kohl's and Target displayed during their respective October hiring sprees, and it certainly signals a lot of what Leighton just talked about with that robust retail landscape. Companies increasingly are looking to add sales forces. We've talked about wages going up in the retail industry overall, and not just because of minimum wage hikes in certain states. Now, looking at the shares of Home Depot, those are off from an all-time high of around $210, $185 now. Still, the company is up 31% in terms of share price over the last year. They were one of the ones hit in the large market sell-off that took place last week. But there is this, as Home Depot continues to buy back stock, and they issue a fairly decent dividend to its shareholders. Big gains seen in terms of capital gains for those who have held on to Home Depot shares over the last five or so years. All of those same store sales figures coming in certainly helping out the share price. I'm not sure if announcing higher employment is going to help out the share price here, but Home Depot, I think it's a positive sign for the retail work community that they're looking to hold on to as many of those 80,000 jobs as possible.
Speaking of positive, Home Depot is not the only home improvement retailer hiring. As noted at the beginning of the story, Lowe's is also now hiring for these seasonal months coming up. And while Lowe's is not hiring as many total people as Home Depot over the coming months, they are still hiring about 18% more than last year, showing an increase in Home Depot's even number there as far as hiring 80,000 people this year versus 80,000 people last year. The hard numbers came in for last year's spring hiring for Lowe's. Around 45,000 people were brought on board temporarily. This year, the company is targeting 53,000 part-time or full-time seasonal helpers. And one caveat there is you see that little full-time note in that a lot of the company workers are going to be able to work 40 hours a week. And so I think this is a good thing if you need not only a little bit of a seasonal job, but you need a little bit of extra cash. Let's say you just retired and you're used to that full-time income. You may be able to work for Lowe's for around 3 to 4 months and get that same amount of hours there coming in. New hires can take advantage of many of the benefits that current permanent workers enjoy. The company listed on their website health plans, a 401k, a discounted stock plan, and tuition reimbursement. And these are all things that these temporary workers will be able to get. Again, Lowe's has the money for hiring, just like their larger competitor in Home Depot. They too took advantage, for lack of a better term, in bringing in sales revenue from the hurricane-affected areas of the South and Southeast. Over $100 million extra in revenue came in during the last couple of months from those damages. You see a lot of people rebuilding in those affected areas. They did, to their credit, donate $2.5 million in relief funds as well. So that took a tiny little notch out of their bottom line. But overall, you see a company that is performing very well over the last year or two. As far as profitably growing, they have done just that. Gross margins are increasing mid-single digits despite investment in a number of key areas, very expensive areas that they're funneling money into. We should note that the company did cut 500 corporate employees and over 1,000 support employees from around the country last year. So we talk about those margins. Those margins will be helped a little bit by laying off some of those longer-term employees that have salary jobs. A strong housing market and an increasing amount of baby boomers retiring with more time on their hands has fueled high-margin categories, but also hobbyist-type areas such as lawn and garden. As for the official press release that the company gave, it was no doubt a concerted effort to draw positive headlines. Obviously, something like this, hiring a lot of workers, does very good things to your PR department, something you can sort of advertise while also getting more employees to actually apply. So it's kind of a two-for-one here. Their own company headline read, "Lowe's hiring more than 53,000 employees to support customers and community." So you can see that the tie-in here is for those regional markets, really saying that we help the entire community, not just those coming in and working with us on a day-to-day basis. And while we understand there is an economic multiplier effect with local jobs, obviously, if you're going to have job income, you're going to be spending that. And usually when you spend that throughout the community. So this actually helps in terms of a portion, at least, of this income, jobs around that city. So roughly 60% of seasonal hires last year left the company, but you could see that 40% stayed on board to help their said communities. Still, though, there is a big positive takeaway in that many will get the opportunities to move on and up with the company, something that Trent had alluded to and talked about with Home Depot. Lowe's here noted that they were the top 10 most customer engaged company per Forbes. This sense of purpose may be exactly what some people are looking for in terms of the workplace environment.
Now, Lowe's shares, ticker LOW, those are also down from all-time highs, now around $96 per share, representing an $80 billion market cap, or close to one-third that of Home Depot. Still, overall, Lowe's share prices have gone up, certainly over the last couple of years, with those robust quarterly earnings statements that Leighton alluded to in the introduction, and it makes the discounted stock for Lowe's employees, even the seasonal workers, that much more tantalizing. But the bigger question here about this story, and we've spent a large chunk of the beginning of the Retail Focus looking at the hiring traditions and the practices going forward for Lowe's and Home Depot on a seasonal basis. The question at the end of the day, though, will these companies be able to find the 133,000 total employees that they are searching for between the two of them? Unemployment rates have been steady from October 2017 to January of this year at 4.1%. And while there are still suggestions out there of underemployment, the reality is that many of these seasonal positions are generally classified, especially the part-time ones, as the positions that underemploy people in the first place. And we talked about the benefits Lowe's is planning on offering. Will these and maybe a slight boost in pay hourly be enough to attract those in the labor market, or will they be left out to dry for some of these positions? Leighton mentioned Lowe's was able to tally 45,000 total seasonal hires last year. Will they be able to meet that same demand this year? That remains to be seen. And here's another smaller question. Leighton mentioned lawn and garden sales in the hobbyist areas. How will those be affected by weather this year? After all, a lot of these seasonal employees are going to be working in the lawn and garden areas of these particular retailers. We look at the weather company by IBM. They're predicting slightly above average temperatures for the majority of the country, excluding the Pacific Northwest and the northern part of the country that borders Canada, in late February and March. While this might hurt some of the winter seasonal lawn and garden sales, think salt, for example, for frozen over driveways, this may bode well for homeowners looking to get an early start on their outdoor work. And early starts, from a retailer's perspective, they lead to less midsummer shrink. The more you can sell before the heat hits in May, June, and July, the less shrink you're going to have in lawn and garden with dead plants. And then also the less shrink you're going to have with sheer overstock for some of those seasonal categories. The problem is with that early start, with that early warm weather, might pressure retailers to hire seasonal staff more quickly. Now, Home Depot, with that system Leighton was discussing, through which they hire 80% of their employees, that might help. But again, the pressure to hire a lot of employees very quickly could come at the cost of employee quality for these two retailers as well. So there's a few different dynamics here, not just the actual hiring dynamic, but watching the weather and the seasonality of things as well.
Well, we transitioned from the home improvement retail sector to a company that is big and always has been big in the health and nutrition-related products industry. This with GNC is they will now have 40% of their company owned by a Chinese pharmaceutical leader. This is they also reported fourth quarter earnings earlier this week that largely met expectations from an analyst side, but failed to meet any strong profitability metrics. GNC is a company that has struggled as of late. They're actually in the midst of an aggressive turnaround strategy. That strategy includes a revamped membership model that we've actually talked at length about on this very podcast, and online initiatives, which includes having an Amazon store that I actually bought from not too long ago, as they had promoted that on their website. They've also partnered with credit cards to offer first-time discounts for website purchases at GNC.com. They've gone through a number of pricing changes on more popular items in order to compete and drive traffic online. They're really having to compete, Trent, with a lot of new entrants such as bodybuilding.com and The Vitamin Shoppe, who offers a website and brick and mortar shops around the country, a company we've talked about also on this podcast. The company has been burdened with a significant amount of debt that has caused some investors to worry, as they are publicly traded, whether or not they will be able to pay back these obligations with the company's declining revenue. They've been reporting negative same-store sales, but this quarter, as we'll talk about at the latter half of the story, is actually slightly positive. In terms of the Harbin Pharmaceutical Group holding company, the Chinese company that is a state-controlled drug maker, China's healthcare industry has grown substantially, and they've really created an emerging industry there that has afforded them the cash in order to purchase these types of holdings. Harbin manufactures or supplies over 1,000 different drugs, spanning pretty much every contemporary category in the drug industry. They will be buying, like I said at the beginning of the story, roughly a 40% stake in GNC in order to do a few key things for the company. The deal is worth about $300 million, $299.9 million to be exact, and includes some possible licensing ties. Harbin is reportedly wanting GNC rights and trademarks, as they will reportedly be setting up a royalty deal in the future. And an interesting note, how many Chinese consumers, if you step back and think about it, are well aware or hyper aware of the GNC platform and their current branding? It's apparently very valuable to them, but to say that it's akin to a McDonald's brand, it's a little bit interesting to me, because this, again, is an industry that has been very big in terms of their growth in the last few years. They have many other brands to choose from. It is interesting to me how the GNC brand may be a little bit more valuable than those that have already been in place for some time. For GNC, they will get a little bit more revenue if a joint venture in China proves successful. What Harbin wants to do is set up shop, either in terms of the online or brick and mortar space, and get 65% of the revenue brought in from the GNC products. GNC, for their part, will still get 35%, which is still better than nothing, plus potential royalties if those deals pan out. Again, this deal is not yet complete, either deal. We're talking about the branding, the licensing deal, or the overall deal to close on the $300 million stake, but it will most likely happen considering GNC's current financial status and the fact that you talk about a lot of antitrust lawsuits, not a lot of competition here in terms of other companies wanting a piece of GNC. You see that fourth quarter earnings came in, Trent. Thanks to the aforementioned marketing initiatives, GNC ended up seeing a rise in same-store sales up to around 5.7%.
That's right. They saw the bump on domestic company-owned stores. Franchise locations only saw a same-store sales boost of 2.0%, in large likelihood because a lot of those initiatives were limited in those locations, something that GNC mentioned as they rolled out their One New GNC initiatives a couple of years ago. Their same-store sales also include online sales from GNC.com. So a lot of online sales mechanisms are going up, and that helps to kind of keep afloat those same-store sales that are pretty even in their brick-and-mortar stores. This didn't help make a GAAP profit, though, as they turned in a GAAP loss of $2.99 per share, $2.99 per share, or a whopping $209 million. Now, that's better than last year's loss, which was $433 million for that same fourth quarter. On an adjusted basis, they were profitable at 25 cents per share. However, this adjustment that they made to get to this 25 cents per share was primarily as a result of indefinite-lived intangible assets, which can mean any number of things, including higher long-term expenses such as supply expense. So a lot of that adjustment we kind of question as GNC came in with a pretty substantial loss in this last quarter. And for some of that money, they didn't make exact specifications as to why. Revenue for GNC's fourth quarter overall fell versus fiscal 2016 by about $12 million to $557 million. However, and this is a big however, if we leave out sales from the divested Lucky Vitamin, revenue was actually up just slightly. We mentioned positive same-store sales. Again, those are made up of stronger comps at company-owned locations versus their franchise locations. So we talk about these negative numbers here, not in terms of same-store sales. They did well on that front, but in terms of the bottom line, what does Harbin see here that is so great? Well, Leighton earlier mentioned, of course, the ability to set up GNC shops on a royalty basis in China, where Harbin would take 65% of the revenue from those, and GNC would take 35% of the revenue. So obviously, a branding part of that. But also GNC did have some of those one-time expenses over the last 2 years that can be seen as legitimate or non-recurring costs. For example, their expenses for property and equipment topped $2.4 million. The second aspect of things that Harbin may be seeing here is that leadership is pointing to accelerated growth internationally, not necessarily domestically, which is where we were talking about the same-store sales, but overseas. And they're also discussing an assortment of new products in this ever-changing supplement industry. There's always innovation here, especially in terms of fat burners in particular in that subsegment. But it is an area that could in the future, especially domestically, see increased regulation as well. Perhaps Harbin is seeing maybe more lax regulations on their front where they're doing operations primarily in China. And they're hoping to bear fruit with that omnichannel infrastructure spending that occurred with GNC in 2017. And additionally, Harbin's hoping the GNC brand will help to leverage their growth in new markets. Now, it's our personal general belief that GNC's brand is still fairly strong, not only despite their struggles, but also because of some lawsuits and some certain claims out there. But regardless, they're in an area where consumers are extremely price conscious, and this is something you see if you price check on Amazon, GNC still having trouble competing on price going forward. And granted, a membership program can always address this, something that GNC is bullish on, their own membership program. And enhancing your own ecosystem, showing that to your customers without them feeling like you're spamming them, also important. I'm just not sure if GNC is completely doing those quite yet as far as their company is concerned. And as we do with many stories, Leighton, let's wrap up by looking at the stock price.
Absolutely. GNC Holdings Incorporated, ticker GNC, down a little bit this week on those fourth quarter earnings. They actually popped initially, but went back to the levels they were at previously, which actually represented 1 year lows of around $3.35 here back in December of 2017. You can see back, Trent, looking back over the previous 12 months, the stock was around $7.64 a share, right now around $4.36 a share as of this recording. But that doesn't give you the full picture of a company that has been struggling mightily over the last 4 to 5 years. Going back to the winter months of 2013, shares are around $60, which represents a massive market cap compared to the $300 million one they have right now. Again, buying a piece of the company for an equivalent amount that the stock is trading right now is going to be a big deal, especially if they can finance some of that debt obligation that we were talking about. The company, a very mature company, but it's in the supplement space, which Trent had alluded to quite clearly, actually, not even alluded to, said very directly that the online entrants are taking a bigger piece of the pie because they're making all of those prices in the supplement market extremely transparent for the consumer that not only wants their products at a good price, but wants them now. And companies like Amazon and The Vitamin Shoppe have that 1 or 2 day shipping that is typically free on orders over $35. So a lot of competition in this space. They need a partner. And I think Harbin Pharmaceuticals can actually fill that void.
Well, when we return after the music, we'll have an interview with Stratix Chief Solutions Officer Gary Lee. He's going to talk about the deployment of mobile as an employee retail solutions tool. The interview took place on the floor at NRF 2018. Before we get to the interview, I want to take a few moments to talk about the Internet Retailer Conference and Exhibition. IRCE is your one-stop shop for all of your e-retail needs. This conference and trade show offers you everything your business needs to stay ahead of your competition in one simple location. Spend some time with us to learn, discover, and network in the world-class city of Chicago. It takes place June 5th through the 8th at McCormick Place West.
IRCE offers 2 full conference days with various tracks with pre- and post-conference workshops discussing all the new industry trends. Their exhibit hall at IRCE features over 600 top solution and technology vendors ready to help your business succeed in every facet. The hall covers over 250,000 square feet of space, which, in reference to our latest story, is around 179 GNCs, making it the largest e-commerce trade show in the industry, ensuring you'll find the solutions you need.
There may not be as many fat-burning pills at IRCE, but they do have other cool things. For example, lots of awesome main stage speakers, including Seth Godin, who's the author of What to Do When It's Your Turn, and Alan Cohen of House, who was the first main stage announced for 2018. Here are some of the other numbers. 10,000 attendees, over 600 solution providers, and 130-plus conference sessions with more than 200 speakers. Go to IRCE.com and click Register to Attend under the Attendees tab and enter promo code RETAIL18 for 10% off conference passes, excluding exhibit hall only passes. That's IRCE.com. Enter promo code RETAIL18 for 10% off conference passes. Welcome back to NRF 2018, the Retail Focus interview series on the floor at NRF 2018. We're calling Deconstructing Retail. And today in our interview, we're not talking necessarily about customer adoption of mobile so much as employee and employer adoption of mobile, with the Chief Solutions Officer of Stratix, Gary Lee, joining us on the Retail Focus podcast. And first, how are you doing at the conference so far? It seems like a very busy booth here.
It's very busy. It's been a great show for us so far. It seems like every year this show gets busier and busier with more attendees. So it's been a great show.
So you guys put out a survey, data from IHL, I believe. Retail's top 5 challenges when deploying mobile. And we're talking about deploying mobile from the employee and the employer perspective, or the retailer's perspective, rather than the customer's perspective, which is one of the reasons why we're interested in this topic. So we'll start off with the most general question. Why should a retailer deploy mobile in their stores?
Sure. Well, as retailers are looking to reinvent brick and mortar, and they're looking to reinvent the reason why their stores exist, a key part of that reinvention that we've been talking about in retail for years is the customer experience. And what do customers experience when they walk in the door? What's their path to purchase? What are the obstacles along the way to that path to purchase? We believe, and the survey results kind of point this out, we believe a key part of improving that customer experience is the role of the sales associate and how that associate works with the customer when they walk into the store. So mobility has a big part of that. With mobile now, the associate can do everything from facilitating an easy return, something the customer bought before and needs to bring back to the store, and then certainly as the customer is going through the path to purchase, be able to look up inventory, look up products, and ultimately even be able to close the deal using mobile POS. The use of mobility really changes how that associate interacts with the customer and thus the customer experience.
And it seems to cut down a lot on that customer experience in terms of not only friction, but time wasted. Typically, you think of going into a retail store, something's out on the shelf, you've got to first run down an associate, then ask them if they have any in the back, they've got to wander back to the back. All of this could take minutes, if not longer than that.
Absolutely.
So in terms of the customer experience, what is your data showing in terms of how that customer experience has helped, not only with your solutions, but solutions in general that tend to cut down that amount of time that a customer has to wait on an employee to give an answer?
Sure, well, applications like Endless Aisle and being able to look up and see exactly what's in inventory and tell a customer immediately that while it's not on the shelf, there's more in the back, and maybe even have a runner in the back bring that product forward. Those types of applications really cut down on the time that a customer spends waiting for help in the store. You know, online we get almost instantaneous feedback. And anytime now in brick and mortar we've got to wait, it feels like a disconnect. It's not the same positive experience we get online. And so being able to manage inventory and look at inventory and help a customer get the product they want, or if they don't have the product in inventory, being able to order that product online and ship to home and therefore please the customer, those remove those friction points in the path to purchase I talked about earlier.
And it gets them to close the deal, as you mentioned, right then, rather than saying, hey, go home, go to your computer, go to your mobile device and order the product separately. It's an all-in-one type of transaction.
Absolutely.
I want to look at it from the retailer's perspective now, and I think a lot of store managers are probably sometimes a little bit negative in terms of giving technology to the store employees. They're worried that things might be misused, they worry, and they're concerned that giving employees mobile solutions might hinder the process more than it might help. What would you say to those retailers?
Well, it's critical that the retailer not just give the technology, it's critical that the retailer also takes the time to properly train on the technology. We sometimes make an assumption that just because we're handing someone a product similar to the one they use for personal use, they automatically know how to use it. But that's not what our experience, being in mobility and retail for 35 years, that's not what our experience shows. The application that we're handing to someone on a mobile device may not be designed well, and therefore the user doesn't understand how to use it. And so it's critical that when we hand someone technology in store, we also take the time to properly train them on how to use that application, how to use that device, but also how to use that device in the sales cycle so that it's not the technology getting in the middle of the relationship between the customer and the salesperson. It's more how technology is enabling that relationship and that conversation that's going on.
And to that point, in that article, Retail's Top 5 Challenges in Deploying Mobile, that you guys have listed on your website, you mentioned ways that retailers can help to train their staff to use that as a conduit and not as a barrier in between them and the customer. And one of the points in particular, and you mentioned to me before the podcast that you're not in the business necessarily of training, but it's important for you to let retailers know how to train, is the looking at a mobile device side by side with a customer. So it's not you and them, it's you and them next to each other. What are some other methods that can help to kind of break down that barrier if employers are worried about employees just looking at their phones or looking at that mobile device the entire time?
Sure. I mean, I call it point of conversation selling. If the store associate is constantly burying their face in the mobile device and no longer making eye contact with a customer or having that conversation with a customer in a very warm, engaging way, then technology's become a crutch in the sales process instead of it being an enabler to closing the deal. And so training a salesperson on how to use the mobile device but continue to have eye contact, not put the mobile device between themselves and the customer, make sure that mobility's there to augment the conversation and supplement the conversation. It doesn't become a whole conversation about the device and everybody's got their nose buried in the device, because at that point in time, the customer can just be shopping on their own device on their own time somewhere else.
Looking at some of the other issues in terms of challenges that retailers face in trying to deploy mobile, I know that one of them that was mentioned was just not having the app or not having the back-end technology. So in terms of what you guys do at Stratix, what can you do to smooth over that leap into employees using mobile to help and assist customers and close that deal to where it doesn't seem like so big of a jump, so big of a chasm?
That's a great question. At Stratix for 35 years, we've been helping retailers plan, deploy, manage, and support mobility. And so the challenges raised in the white paper, where retailers are saying they know they need to deploy mobility for their employees' use, but they're struggling with getting the right application on the device. They're struggling with having a help desk to support their users. They're struggling with managing the devices. All of these challenges that retailers mentioned in this survey are ones that we see every day. And so Stratix, we have a suite of managed mobile services where we will come in with the retailer and provide the expertise, provide the staff, provide the resources they need so that they can deploy mobility. We put our managed services in play. We're 7x24. We're actually managing those devices and in turn those users for the retailer. So it gives them the staff they need to properly pull off mobility. It gives them the expertise they need to properly pull off mobility.
again, devil's advocate from the retail store manager side, they might say, well, we only have one, two, three stores in our chain. Is this something that could be adopted by, you know, not just the largest of brick and mortars out there?
Sure. I think anyone deploying mobility today, they really don't have the expertise in mobility. They've got the expertise in retail. They've got the expertise on their store, their customers. They're not mobile experts, and that's okay. It's time to bring in an expert anytime you're trying to do a technology deployment to make sure that it's going to be successful. And that's true for the small chains, it's true for the big chains.
And that's a good point, and that's kind of what I wanted to bring this all around on. Retailers, generally, we'd like to think that they're experts in retailing, and unless you're a few retailers that aren't doing perhaps so well right now, but they might not have a foothold in the technological areas of expertise that, say, Stratix would. How important is it for a retailer to make sure that they consult actual help for any technological need, not just what we're talking about today, from the outside, rather than just trying to shoehorn a system in place using the staff they have on place that may not have a very good grasp of the technology and, moreover, what consumers want from the technology?
You know, I think it's critical, especially when we do look at the state of retail today, where boards are making hard decisions on what capital to spend and how to spend capital. And let's face it, retail is changing dramatically and is changing fast. So I think anytime we're making a decision to do something new in retail, we need to be smart about it. And that means bringing in people to help. Bring in people that are experts in the subject matter, bring in experts on the technology so that you've got the best chance of that deployment going smoothly and you achieve the business results you're looking for out of the technology.
To close, I want you to walk us through, if you can, the experience from the employee's perspective. Let's say a customer comes in, they want product X isn't on the shelf. Using the type of technology that you've set up, what would the employee experience be from then on out as they're trying to help the customer find a solution?
Sure. Where we see mobility being used well at the front of the house in retail, the associates are equipped with a smart device, a tablet, a smartphone, or something like that. They greet the customer when they walk in. Where appropriate, they look up the customer loyalty information for that customer so they can look at past purchases and know more about the customer. But really, when the customer comes in, 9 times out of 10, they've already done their research. They know what they're there for. And so the role of the associate becomes very much a shepherd in that environment. They're there to make sure that the customer can find the product they're looking for, do inventory checks to see if the product's in stock or not, or make sure the order can be fulfilled and maybe shipped to home. There's also an opportunity for the associate to upsell, especially in fashion retail or in other retailers where they can look to see what the customer's looking for and point out accessories and other things that maybe the customer hadn't considered. So really the role of the associate now becomes one of shepherding and guiding and assisting, and at the end of the day, trying to make sure that customer walks out with what they came for and maybe just a little bit extra in their shopping cart as well.
I really like that term, shepherd. I think that brings together what we're looking at right now in today's retail landscape quite nicely. Well, once again, Gary Lee, Chief Solutions Officer with Stratix, thanks so much for joining us on the Retail Focus Podcast, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Well, we thank Gary Lee for taking the time to join us back at NRF 2018, and we look forward now to leadership in the food area. You heard the music. It's time for kind of a food focus within the Retail Focus Podcast as Chipotle takes a CEO out of the hands of Taco Bell. Shares of the embattled fast casual chain were up double digits on the news, but we should shed light on the fact that they were at multi-year lows as a stock prior to the deal. Chipotle, as we have noted so many times at this point, is over a year out from food safety issues that hospitalized dozens. In fact, well over a year out, nearly 2 years at this point. Comps were down for this year over last up until recently. Now sales are increasing against easier quarterly revenues. Traffic levels are still not ideal despite new products such as queso, for example. Heightened marketing and a completely non-GMO stance, all of which put in place following the food safety issues. But revenues are up as of last quarter, which was a function of higher prices, which some, us included, had criticized for taking place in too many markets overall and hurting potential customer loyalty. Fast forward to now, where Chipotle found themselves without a leader after founder and CEO Steve Ells said he would be stepping aside into a full-time executive chairman role to focus more on his passion, which is sourcing sustainable and healthy food for the company. And although they were without leadership, they weren't without leadership for long.
This sort of took us by surprise, because if you go back 6 months ago, we've been talking a lot about activist investor Bill Ackman and his role, or at least the role he's trying to employ within Chipotle. as his company owns, his hedge fund owns around 10 or 11% of the company, the largest stake by volume. And I say that to say this, Bill Ackman has actually made comments publicly on CNBC and other platforms saying that he really didn't see a need for the company's CEO and founder Steve Ells to step aside. And so you see these quarters here lately where they have been increasing same-store sales, they've been increasing revenue. However, they are not where they once were. They're up against a lot easier comps. So you're going back a year, year and a half ago. This is exactly the time in which food safety issues were paramount. It was all over the news. People stopped going into Chipotle because they were afraid they were going to have to be hospitalized 5 hours later. And I think Bill Ackman was really bullish on the fact that Steve Ells had led the company to this point, had made a very successful company, and he looked at this as just a simple roadblock, something they could get around within a few months' time. But this has turned into a much bigger problem, and I think now a bigger opportunity is they're looking to transfer into another CEO position, a new leadership direction, if you will. And you see that months later, after publicly laying out a somewhat tepid growth plan for the next year or two, the company is needing a new leadership direction. And I think a lot of analysts are agreeing with this, saying that, you know what, we tried to give Steve Ells an adequate amount of time to turn the company around, but we need some fresh blood in there. And Taco Bell is viewed as an indirect competitor to Chipotle, but not many people would think of them as a direct competitor because of the food quality. They only really both focus on Mexican cuisine. Aside from that, drastic differences in terms of food prep, the menu, and the overall environment. If you compare a Chipotle to a Taco Bell, completely different in the food industry. And that is not to say Chipotle couldn't learn a few things from a massive rebranding that Yum Brands has owned from the last few years with Taco Bell over the last 6 years or so. They've done a lot in terms of limited time offerings, actually remodeling a few locations. And one person that has been credited with Taco Bell's latest turnaround is Brian Nichol, who joined Taco Bell in 2011 and became chief executive in 2015. So you can see that he actually made it up through the ranks fairly fast. He has now been chosen to lead Chipotle. And so this is why we're talking about Taco Bell here, because a very different QSR here. We're talking about a typical QSR versus what some would call a fast casual. How can Brian Nichol turn this company around? Again, analysts applauded the move this week as they said that he carries a respectable track record through his experience with Taco Bell. A quick background through Brian Nichol, and you see that he's actually been a brand advocate, so to speak, for all of the brands that he's worked with for Taco Bell since he became CEO. He was actually in charge of marketing. He often talks about how people buy into a brand, not simply buying from a brand. And so he related this to Taco Bell in that he was seeing Taco Bell as merely a destination. People were hungry, so they just stopped by. But he turned that into an overall experience. You're saying, you know what? Taco Bell is more than just a destination for a food product. It's an overall brand. You're having to buy into the brand in order to create long-term value from that core customer. He's actually only 43 years old and came to the restaurant industry with an engineering degree of all things, an MBA in business, a little bit later, a 10-year stint at consumer products giant Procter & Gamble, and he's with Yum Brands, where he actually started with Pizza Hut in 2005, worked there until 2011, again, focused on branding at both Procter & Gamble and Pizza Hut. And he joined Taco Bell and really turned that company around. And you fast forward to now, it seems as though he didn't have some sort of long-term contract in place, or if he did, it just expired, because he will actually officially start on the job at Chipotle in about 2 weeks' time from the recording this podcast. In fact, March 5th is when he's going to be assigned the CEO role. And so far, Trent, those in the know have speculated that his focus will be on two broad areas, operations and marketing. And yes, you have to take a step back, because operations has a lot to do with pretty much everything in a typical restaurant, and marketing, of course, because of his experience within Pizza Hut and Taco Bell. But from the digital front, he made ordering at Taco Bell a lot easier with kiosk and mobile applications, while Chipotle just came out with a much better iteration of their long-standing online ordering platform. Things could still get ironed out. A lot of people are still complaining about some of the flexibility with that platform. They obviously don't have kiosks either, does Chipotle. and they have a lot of work to go in terms of Chipotle's assembly line type setup if they were to create more orders from a kiosk perspective. Taco Bell, for reference, created their mobile ordering platform under Nichols' leadership for all 7,000 plus locations in the United States and gave more flexibility to franchisees in terms of marketing and point of sale efforts. They were actually given allotment for those who are interested to have kiosks inside the location. So they were actually given the money to purchase things to enhance the customer experience, something that you don't hear at all from Chipotle, Trent, because they don't have any franchise locations. So different dynamic here, but a lot of interesting things that could happen in the future for Chipotle.
In a statement Tuesday, Nichols said he wanted Chipotle to provide a consistently great customer experience. And in terms of back-end operations, Chipotle just went through a new food prep and supplier strategy as well. After the E. coli and norovirus outbreak, they looked individually at each ingredient to see how they could better safeguard against contamination. As a result, they've looked a little bit more closely into supplier cleaning techniques for especially the vegetables. And also, they prep more produce now in-house rather than receiving it already chopped or prepped. One option Nickel might have would be to cheapen the ingredients and perhaps move in the opposite direction to the company's original mission of serving sustainably sourced, all-natural, organic food. Now, this would improve margins, but it could hurt the brand and would also go against what we just said Steve Ells said he was aiming to do, which is to source and increasingly source sustainable, healthy food for the company. So I don't think this is an option that he's going to pick up, and I think Layton's in that same box as well. Another more reasonable option for him instead would be to have limited LTOs or at least be more aggressive with trying out potentially permanent new items. People have mentioned that oftentimes with a change in CEO at food companies, you see new menus and it looks as though Chipotle could be ripe for at least a changed menu, especially with the sheer number of items on Taco Bell's menu under Nichols' watch. And until recently, Chipotle had a fairly conservative menu that wasn't easily changed. I think the number one thing Chipotle may look at going forward is the addition of nachos. A lot of other fast casual or Mexican QSR plus chains are going to nachos. Chipotle's got the queso now. They've got all the individual ingredients, including the tortillas. I think they can just keep adding items to their menu. That's part of what made Taco Bell so special in the QSR space, is the constant innovation, the constant exploration into new avenues in which to bring in customers. Queso alone was credited with a 2% increase in average check this last quarter. They have to find a way to leverage that in different ways outside of just glooping it onto whatever customers get there at Chipotle or serving it as a side with chips on their own. Now, Els said whatever the company chooses to do product-wise, they're not going to compromise food integrity. Again, kind of playing against the notion that we lobbed up just a few moments ago that they could have the option potentially of cheapening the food or going through cheaper suppliers. In terms of other innovations, the Chicago Tribune has gone a step further in indicating there might be some huge changes on the horizon for Chipotle, breakfast being one of them. Taco Bell is one of the few restaurants that's made a foray into breakfast, where they've actually managed to drive additional traffic through the addition of breakfast rather than just saying breakfast all day. Now, this would mean hours change for Chipotle and also sourcing a bunch more food, mainly eggs, but also potentially bringing back chorizo as a breakfast sausage. But it would also mean a handsome amount of positive PR, and I bet that a lot of people out there would love to not wait until 11 a.m. to get their Chipotle every day, especially their devoted consumers. Drive-thrus are another option. Chipotle still have a drive-up space where people can get out of their car and run in and get the order, but now we're seeing a lot of places in the QSR Plus space or the fast casual space either add drive-thru windows or have employees carry purchases out to customers in the car. So there are a number of different things around here that Chipotle might be innovating around. The idea of Chipotle breakfast via a drive-thru, that's pretty enticing to me. I don't know about Layton, but shares were at 2012 lows before the news of a new CEO and maybe a brighter future. They're around $285 per share now from $250 per share. Still a robust market cap of $8 billion, which is just 2x annual revenue and roughly 1/3 of the valuation the company had back in August of 2015.
With Trent finishing off the last half of the Chipotle story, I am now extremely hungry for Chipotle breakfast and am going to personally be writing Brian Nickel on March 5th to make sure he makes all of these things happen, because this is something we've been talking about for quite some time, breakfast at Chipotle. It is indeed a really enticing option to think about. We go back into mall retail for our last story, with Genesco looking to divest Lids, the hat store or sports memorabilia store, from its portfolio and use these proceeds to assert itself as a contender in the footwear industry. Genesco is sadly a company we have only talked about once before on the podcast for an earnings call. In fact, Genesco operates several mall staples, some you may be very aware of, including Journeys, Little Burgundy, and Johnston and Murphy, which is an upscale retailer for men and women with footwear, handbags, apparel, and accessories. And lastly, Shoe, a UK-based fashion footwear retailer with over 120 stores in all of Europe. I believe they have operations in Ireland, Germany, and the UK. As we list off their current retail store divisions, eight in all, a theme emerges indeed. That theme is footwear, something that all have in common except for Lids, which only has hats, shirts, jerseys, and professional team memorabilia. If you go on their website, they do have a lot of team memorabilia. The company, with all of the retail stores and leased apartments, has around 2,794 locations, and this was at the end of fiscal 2017, which is actually down from 2015 and 2016 numbers when they had over 2,800 stores. So they are downsizing just a little bit. Journeys group segment, which included Journeys, Journeys Kids, Little Burgundy, and Underground by Journeys, accounted for roughly 44% of the company's revenue in fiscal 2017. They had 27 stores in terms of net new stores coming on board in 2017, and footwear here was one of the strongest categories mentioned by the company's press release. This compares to Lids Sports Group, which accounted for roughly 29% of the net sales brought in from Genesco in 2017. And this includes both online and in-store sales. So you can see here, by contrasting these two major retail groups for Genesco, that Lids Sports Group actually brings in quite a bit of revenue, almost 30% of the total revenue in 2017. Same-store sales for Lids increased 4% for the 4 year, and net direct sales from e-commerce increased 2%. So fairly good numbers from a retailer a lot have said has been struggling as of late. Comps during the holidays did, however, fall a dramatic 14%, though. This when all other segments were positive in terms of retail segments at their other stores like Journeys during the holiday shopping season. For Lids, they have 1,240 stores in all, most of them leased, which includes Lids locker room and clubhouse locations. And as we compare both Journeys segment and the Lids Sports Group segment, we see that the operating margin is quite a bit less than their normal operating margin at Journeys, let's say, and they have a less amount of growth in terms of unit sales. So you're seeing that Lids, while they have been growing, they're going at a much slower rate than Journeys. However, if you compare Lids with other retailing operating divisions such as Shoe Group and Johnston & Murphy Group, they are still larger by a percent of revenue, as I had said. And if you dig deeper into their performance within these other groups, you see that the margins are still going to be better than Lids and the other companies, with the exception of UK's Shoe Group, and they're performing much better in the online space. For instance, e-commerce sales ended up popping 8% for Johnston & Murphy. So Lids has not been able to execute at a very high level in terms of the e-commerce sales, but I think there is an opportunity, Trent, to extract value longer term and potentially reinvest these funds into their better performing segments.
One of the things I do worry about here for Genesco is they are selling Lids a little bit low. Now, their same store sales were up, as you mentioned, 4% for the full year at Lids. But you look at the e-commerce segment, and Lids has a lot of competitors out there, most of which are going to be competitive or better than Lids on price. And one of the constant complaints about Lids in terms of their online or e-commerce sales is the fact that they aren't very competitive in the e-commerce realm on price. And you look at a company like Fanatics, which is now adding a lot of hat wear and other sports gear to their website, where they're essentially selling direct to the public a lot of that which they manufacture. That's going to make it very difficult for Lids to serve as a middleman when people are instead going direct to the manufacturer. The same could be said of New Era, one of the largest hat wear manufacturers in the country based out of Buffalo, New York. Now, the company here, Genesco, overall has been very transparent about their competition in the mall spaces in nearly all categories, highlighting both footwear and sports apparel in their store segments. And this is perhaps what's pushing management in the direction to divest Lids. They need to be able to focus on those other parts of the business involving footwear that are similar so they can gain profitability in a more meaningful way. And it's not that they're losing money on Lids, at least not yet, but Genesco stated that a strategic review has made it clear that selling Lids off would be the best decision for the company and its shareholders. They could, of course, use the money, certainly, as part of that deal. But additionally, you don't worry about long-term operating costs for Lids. And in a written statement from James Bradford, who is Genesco's lead independent director and chairman of this special committee formed to explore the Lids sale, he mentioned that Lids is undervalued as a part of Genesco. Its sale would generate capital that the company can, and I quote, deploy productively to further enhance shareholder value, end quote. This can mean a number of different things, whether it's reinvestment in their existing firms or even something as simple as share buybacks. Now, some have pointed to problems in NFL merchandise demand as TV ratings did suffer a little bit during the last season, although Super Bowl ratings in terms of share were excellent this year. Despite what you might be reading out there, the share of televisions turned on to the Super Bowl was very strong. And Lids recently, they've spent more money on customizability and having marketing events that circulate surrounding different sporting events. Some analysts are speculating that selling the more than 1,000 Lids locations could bring the company and its shareholders around $250 million if successful. The real question, though, is who is going to spend the $250 million, especially given the competitive landscape, and have it not be an antitrust issue? Because at this point, you're seeing the number of overall hat retailers in the marketplace and hat-specific retailers in the marketplace begin to dwindle. And Leighton, this conversation may have started all the way back with activist pressure.
There is an activist investor on board as part of owning some of the shares. Legion Partners managing director Chris Kuiper said in an email, "We are disappointed that the board did not initiate a more thorough, comprehensive review of all strategic alternatives. A sale of Lids, in our view, does not go far enough in resolving the significant underperformance issues at the company." And I think this is very interesting because Genesco actually fired back in a note, but overall, you're seeing that this activist investor has only been on board for a few months. So it's a little interesting because they're trying to push the company around and they're still not happy. They're basically saying that we want more divisions sold off from the company. But it's interesting because, as we mentioned, pretty much all of the divisions except for the shoe group, really similar. So I think if you were to sell off a division, I think Lids Sports Group is going to be the one to do that. And I think if you're saying that they are underperforming in terms of their overall market valuation right now as part of the entire Genesco portfolio, and perhaps we can extract more value by divesting as a whole, I think that is the best thing to do for the company. And not only that, Legion Partners could actually get some sort of a one-time payment if this sale does happen, because I don't think they would invest 100% of the proceeds from a divestment back into the business. But I digress. We see that the shares of Genesco, ticker GCO, are hovering around $38 a share, which is not bad because if you look for historical measure at the 52-week highs, around $63 a share, but lows of around $20 a share. So it's been worse for the company. Right now, there just needs to be something firm and in place to lead the company into a new 2018. And I think shares did spike on Wednesday after the news about 9.2% because the other shareholders, aside from this one activist investor, are applauding the changes at the company and realizing that the management is acknowledging the problems that Lids has been having as far as underperforming versus their other retail segments.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We close out this edition of the Retail Focus podcast with our Looking Ahead segment, where each Leighton and I look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on for the next week or month. We begin with Leighton.
I'll keep it short and sweet, and this with a company that I actually have in my own personal stock portfolio and have for some time. I've been long in JCPenney, and I'm actually down in the position a little bit. And longtime listeners will realize here that JCPenney has been struggling after the last several quarters or so, but they did turn in a very, albeit very slight profit last year, and they may be looking to have a good quarter as they are actually going to be reporting on fourth quarter here in a couple of weeks. But JCPenney, this is what my looking ahead is about, is actually trimming 8 more stores this year, which isn't a lot if you compare them to other legacy mall retailers such as Sears, who has been trimming hundreds per year. JCPenney will also be closing a distribution center. And that's really what I want to focus on here, because the 8 stores, if you look at those locations, they're in very small markets. And some of those locations, Trent, they did not own. So those lease agreements probably came up and they said, you know what? These 8 stores are not big enough to have a Sephora in-house, not big enough to have a beauty section in-house, or a hair styling area in-house. So I think this is going to be a big move, but the distribution center, according to some analysts, could be worth over $50 million because this distribution center resides in Wisconsin, and it's actually an area that is sort of up and coming. So they're actually saying the land alone could actually be worth more than $50 million. And this is a distribution center that was actually built in the late 1950s. So if you're talking about inefficiencies here, they're probably paying a lot for the building maintenance. They're probably paying a lot in terms of just holding onto this asset that may not be as efficient in terms of also distribution. They're actually saying JCPenney is that they're going to be able to have 2 other distribution centers easily take on what this distribution center has been processing over the last few years. And I think this is very good for the company because not only can you extract that value, but you're being a little bit more efficient with your current operations. So you're going to be able to trim costs for the long term and deploy capital in the short term. So this is a win-win for the company as the company, again, looks towards profitability in this upcoming quarter.
Well, longtime listeners of the podcast know that one area of retail that interests me greatly is in terms of beer and liquor retail, whether that's in a grocery store or in a freestanding location. And the story I'm looking ahead to will take place next Wednesday as the Boston Beer Company releases results for their operating fourth quarter. Now, the reason I'm looking here is that Boston Beer Company has seen a decline in shipments and depletions over the course of the last year. First, I want to see if that decline continues, but secondly, I'm anxious to see how they talk about the addition of President and CEO Dave Berwick, who was hired on Valentine's Day, February 14th. Berwick comes to Samuel Adams, or the Boston Beer Company, via Pete's Coffee, where he's been the CEO for the last 6 years, give or take a few months. Anyhow, the reason I'm looking at the Boston Beer Company is not so much because depletions are down, and I expect that to continue. It's because Sam Adams, as a beer brand, has commanded a lot of shelf space in a number of liquor and beer retailers throughout the country. How well they do in this fourth quarter and ensuing quarters will determine how much shelf space they're going to be taking up in stores. If orders continue to sag for the Boston Beer Company, it could mean that's because they're giving up shelf space to other competitors. And I'll be anxious to see which competitors those are and how quickly certain retailers react to try and scrunch the shelf space that Sam Adams is given if demand for Sam Adams continues to be tepid in the future. So there's a lot of dynamics to watch. First, for Boston Beer Company as a whole, but second, how liquor retailers treat Sam Adams going forward. Again, just like Sierra Nevada, which we've talked about on the Food Focus, those are kind of legacy craft, in quotes, brewers that are being squeezed out by a lot of smaller craft brewers. They've lost shelf space. Sierra Nevada's lost a lot of shelf space, particularly in the middle part of America. Could Sam Adams be next? That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Remember, if you've made it this far, be sure and like us or rate us wherever you are listening to us and wherever podcasts are available. And we'll be back next week with another Retail Focus.
Been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.